This week on Pirate Party Radio, Facebook releases even more of your profile you once thought was private. Ireland implements the three strikes rule and considers website blocking as well. And the Act-A-Text is finally released. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 25 for Thursday, April 22nd, 2010.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last cause. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. Right off the top of the show, of course, everybody knows it now, the ACTA is now released. The ACTA full text has been released into the public, the official release of it. And Rick Falvinge responds to it in this manner. This is sent in by Legion. ACTA is worse than we ever imagined. Today is the text of the ACTA release. It is true that this does not contain three strikes. It contains language relating to one strike. One indictment of big business and you're banned from the network. Pirate Party takes to the streets planning demonstrations this Saturday, and I have some more information about that later. The relevant text is as follows. According, in order to facilitate the continued development of an industry engaged in providing information services online, while also ensuring that measures to take adequate and effective action against copyright or related rights infringement are available and reasonable, each party shall or may A. provide limitations on the scope of civil remedies against an online service provider for infringing activities that occur by 1. automatic technical process, and 2. the actions of the provider's users that are not directed or initiated by that provider when the provider does not select the material, and 3. the provider referring or linking users to an online location. When in cases of subparagraph 1 and 2, the provider does not have actual knowledge of the infringement and is not aware of facts or circumstances from which infringing activity is apparent. The issue here is that ISPs are not liable for file sharing on their networks under certain conditions. The conditions of termination in the same second as the internet provider becomes aware of the alleged infringement, the last part of the text. It aims, therefore, on the liability of the internet service providers and ensures that they can only be held harmless if they immediately turn off any claims that file sharing or otherwise violate intellectual property rights. The effect is that the internet providers must enter their subscribers' contracts in that they turn off as soon as they receive such complaints. It is an extremely ugly way to go around the legislative process. No rule of law, no court, a large finger pointing, and you will be blocked off from society, and the method of achieving it will be fear and terror. I'm not going to take this kind of crap. See you on the streets on Saturday. So what they're saying is that if they are alerted, if an ISP that you're on is alerted that you are doing infringing on copyright and they don't turn you off immediately to prevent this copyright infringement from taking place, they in turn will be held responsible for the copyright infringement. And of course, no ISP would like to take on the liability of a copyright infringement from one person. So what they're going to do in effect is have to turn them off, or else the copyright holders are saying, well, we did alert you to this copyright infringement, and by facilitating or letting this person continue this copyright violation, say you're downloading a torrent that takes 3 hours, they alert you, and you allow this second and third hour to keep going on, you are therefore liable for the copyright infringement that is happening in the second and third hour because you are aware of it and you're letting it happen. Some very scary wording going on in the ACTA text. So I'll talk about more about the ACTA text and what else it is going to implement if passed by all the countries that are participating. And there are a lot of countries around the world, and you probably live in one of them if you are understanding the words that I'm saying, speaking English. Net neutrality news from Europe. Commissioner pledges protection for net neutrality. Some good news. Sent in by Nephilim. The last one was sent in by Legion, if I didn't mention that. Internet users must be able to access whatever content they want, regardless of telecoms companies' demands that high bandwidth publishers pay them, according to a European commissioner ahead of a consultation on net neutrality. So good for him. Digital Agenda Commissioner Neelie Kroes said that whatever business model internet service providers choose, it must not interfere with customers' access to whatever services they require from the internet. Kroes said that the commission would begin a consultation on the controversial issue of net neutrality before the summer. Net neutrality is the principle that all traffic flowing through the ISP systems should be treated the same so that customers all have equal access to online content, regardless of the business relationship between the content producer and their ISP. Telecom companies have argued for a number of years that they deserve to be paid by the publishers of the content that demands high bandwidth, such as video sites, because this puts a bigger strain on the networks and forces them to upgrade. Opponents argue that the internet should be neutral and that the ISP customer pays for the access to the whole internet and whatever they find on it, not for faster access to whatever content producers pay their ISP for preferential treatment. The net neutrality debate is far advanced in the U.S., where lawmakers have discussed several propositions to legislate on the issue, where telecom companies have publicly stated their view that they should be paid by the content producers for preferential access to customers. Kroes said that while she wants to remain open to all views and not prejudge the issue, she was committed to some basic principles of internet access. In 2005, the Federal Communications Commission of the United States outlined four principles to encourage broadband deployment and preserve the open and interconnected nature of the public internet, she said. These were rights for customers to access lawful internet content of their choice, to run applications and services of their choice, to connect devices of their choice, and to have competition. I can fully subscribe to these principles. Kroes said that consumers must not have their basic rights undermined and must be armed with the full knowledge of whatever measures are put in place by ISPs. I will not support any outcome that puts in danger the freedom of expression, she said. In a complex system like the internet, it must be crystal clear what the practices of the operators controlling the network mean for all users, including consumers. We have to adopt clear regulatory measures to foster investment in new, efficient, and open networks, says Kroes. Deploying such networks and promoting infrastructure competition may be the best way to avoid bottlenecks and monopolistic gatekeepers, thereby ensuring net neutrality. Well, net neutrality would, in effect, if the ISPs got their way, they would turn down the whole internet except for the people that pay them to let their videos through or their streaming radio through or even their web pages through at a high speed. So they can turn everything down to a crawl, say, except for maybe if Google pays them a whole boatload of cash to get them through faster than the other video hosting sites. So in effect, also they can hit it from the other side as well, from the consumer standpoint, saying that, well, if you don't pay us for the video bundling package or the audio streaming bundling package, then you don't get those parts of the internet. And effectively, kind of a roundabout way of censoring people that don't have the big pockets of cash to pay all these ISPs around the world, really holding the internet for ransom for the highest bidder. So they could even put it in tiers of, you know, Google pays so much for the YouTube streaming, and then another video site can pay a little bit more, and they'll be able to get, you know, double the speed of YouTube. But YouTube's a little bit faster than the people who pay nothing at all. And really, that's the downfall of what the internet should be. This is what makes the internet so great, is that everybody is put on an even playing field. You can put up a website, and you pay for that website to be up there already, and the other end consumer pays the ISP so that they can get access as well. Everybody gets paid, and the information gets from end to end. And what the ISPs want to do is to be able to control the data and even get more money out of it than was originally intended. And they can do that without, if there are no rules to be implemented, they can go ahead and do that. And this is really a restriction on data access itself for the people. And it's more than just money. It's about being able to access the data that's put out there. And there really isn't enough competition. The argument against that is that there's enough competition out there that the consumers can and vote with their feet and go to the people, go to the ISPs that you know, that offer the access that they want. But in the U.S., I think I mentioned it a little bit further down, or I've mentioned it in other shows, is that there's only one ISP in some certain areas of the U.S. and around the world. You only get one choice, or you get no choice. You get no internet. These filtered, artificially slowed down internet, or you get no internet at all because of the number of internet providers that are in your area. So there really is no choice. And what has made the internet so great is now being tried to being choked off. Free speech news from Ireland. I've got two stories from Ireland, actually. Putting up barriers to a free and open internet, sent in by Mind Inversion. The government has had extensive private discussions on introducing internet blocking, barring access to websites or domains, according to material obtained under a Freedom of Information request. The approach is used by some internet providers and mobile network operators to block access to child pornography, but increasingly governments and law enforcement agencies are pushing for much broader use, ranging from blocking file sharing sites to trying to tackle cybercrime and terrorism. Critics say internet blocking creates many problems with little real effect on illegal activity. For example, internet users and businesses have complained about the side effects of domain blocking, where barring access domains could shut down hundreds of personal and business websites as well as email addresses associated with them. The exact nature of the government discussions cannot be determined as many of the requests for key documents were refused by the Department of Justice. However, the ongoing high level of discussion on the subject is indicated in the detailed description of each refused item in the list of materials returned by the department. The FOI request made by privacy advocate Digital Rights Ireland and seen by the Irish Times contain 8 pages of listed documents. One refused item details a June 2009 meeting between the department and Vodafone on the introduction of internet filtering in Ireland. Another is an email from mobile operator 3 listing filtering technologies it's using. Another refused item details minutes of a meeting between the Office for Internet Safety and Garda, re-proposed introduction of blocking technology, discussions on the international use of blocking and on proposed European legislations were also refused. Now, the problem with implementing this blocking technology, website blocking technology, IP blocking technology, any kind of blocking technology mandated by the government or even ISPs, is that in the original intention of the blocking software or technology, almost everybody somewhat agrees to it. It's like the stopping child pornography. That's always the key to get it going and get it implemented. But then everybody else has their own opinion of what should or shouldn't be allowed on the internet or allowed for their citizens to be accessed on the internet. And it goes down a slippery slope. Everybody's moral authority gets mixed up in this software blocking technology now that it's implemented. So the software businesses want any kind of distribution, unauthorized distribution of their software blocked. Musicians and music rights holders want any unauthorized block, any authorized sharing of their music blocked, even down to fair use amounts of their music blocked, 5 second, 10 second clips, video clips, any kinds of things like that. People who want to claim copyright on ideas of that they've put on the internet that somebody else posts, they want their website shut down, they want even speech shut down because somebody is saying something that they don't like against them. They go to the ISP and say, turn this person's website off, let nobody access it, because I'm going to take them to court, and I'm going to take you to court too, because you are allowing this speech to go through your internet. So that gets put in the block list. So everybody can jump on the block list as soon as it's implemented, and it's not just for child pornography anymore. It's for anything that somebody doesn't like, or somebody thinks that the another person should not see it, or the rest of the world should not see it. And it's a very, very obvious slippery slope. And a slippery slope argument is in itself a slippery slope argument. But in this case, it's what happens, and it's been shown around the world to happen many times. Another story from Ireland, sent in by Mind Inversion. Copyright news. Major labels go bra. Irish judge allows 3 strikes. The Irish High Court ruled on April 16th that cutting off the internet access of suspected peer-to-peer pirates was fine, that no data privacy rules would be breached by doing so, and that such schemes are needed because the mischievous side of the human personality, containing a repulsive aspect as well as an attractive and humorous one, has also come to the fore over the internet. Very strange statement. When the major music labels in Ireland sued IRCOM, one of the country's largest ISPs, the case was eventually settled out of court. The labels wanted IRCOM to take some responsibility for the file-sharing behavior of its subscribers, and the company agreed to implement a voluntary 3-strike system that would result in internet disconnection. This made the lawsuit go away. But the Data Protection Commissioner of Ireland raised objections to the proposal, and the country's High Court was asked to weigh in on its legality. The judgment has arrived, and it pulls no punches. Mr. Justice Charlton refers to illegal downloads of music and movies with a wide variety of synonyms: theft, stealing, filtering, plague of copyright infringement. He has already approved an IRCOM block of the entire Pirate Bay website. When it comes to actual technology involved here, the justice betrays a certain lack of confidence. Again, reviewing the evidence that I've heard in this case, it seems to operate like this, he says, trying to describe peer-to-peer technology. Or again, as I understand the evidence that I've heard, or again, as one can find out by looking at the IP number, I understand. The justice system refers to legal alternatives to illicit downloading, such as an iPlayer system. When he's writing to the BBC's well-known iPlayer catch-up service, he refers to numerous times in order to DetectNet, a company which can find peer-to-peer infringers, when he really means DetectNet. A strong grasp of the technical details won't be found in this ruling, though the broad understanding of the issues seem to be correct. Much odder still is the fact that through this case turns on questions of privacy, data privacy. Ireland's data protection commissioners did not even testify. Why not? The data protection commissioner did not appear because of the concern of indemnity as to his costs. Awesome. No problems here. Shutting off internet access seems like a heavy-handed remedy to the real issue of online copyright infringement. Given the incredible utility of the internet, which is used to do everything from making phone calls to paying bills to sending email to watching video to playing video games to conducting commerce, cutting off a connection completely over the downloading of music raises questions about proportionality. Those questions are obviously stronger when applied to a household, where 5 people might share this crucial resource, but only a 14-year-old daughter has decided to download some Justin Bieber track she heard on the radio. and to do it all without judicial oversight or judicial appeal, could that be fair? Earcom's approach does allow private appeal to the company, which has the last word. The labels have undertaken similar lawsuits against other ISPs, seeking to make the scheme a national one without having to pass a law. The French constitutional counselor says no when the government tried to mandate a similar scheme. The law had to be reworked in order to add oversight. Similarly, the European Parliament has objected for years on the same ground. None of that has any resonance with the Irish High Court. The sharp legal reasoning behind the Irish decision? Some would argue that is an imposition on human freedom. There is no freedom, however, to break the law. So a very mighty decision from Ireland coming out, and I think these people don't understand the importance of the internet nowadays. They see it as a gateway to just look at websites and to, you know, send an email once in a while, and they see no imposition on cutting off people's access to the internet. They don't see it as essential as the phone or transportation or other, you know, modern conveniences that we use day to day, and they don't see how important and how entrenched it is in the younger generations, or even, you know, older generations that use it on a daily basis to communicate and connect and to even, you know, make their living on the internet. And by saying that the internet is inconsequential and be able to cut it off at a whim, at an accusation from a corporation saying that you are stealing money from me. What other words did they use? A plague of copyright infringement, theft and stealing. It really is disproportionate to the hardship that people are going to succumb to when their internet is gone. Or even as they say in here, if one person in a household does the infringement, the rest are punished, because that internet was not in the name of that person. It was in the name of the person who runs the household or pays the bills for the internet. It's really disproportional that they're going against going after the ISPs now, and they're putting it on the ISPs to disconnect people from the internet. And this is really the wrong way about going about it. Well, the whole thing is the wrong way about going about it, even going after people for doing this. They're trying to prop up a crippled system for making money, an outdated, outmoded system for making money off of their intellectual property. In privacy news from the U.S., sent in by D.C., internet privacy attitudes shifting. This is a report. A new study shows people are becoming wary and more cautious about internet privacy. The University of California report is based on conversations with 1,000 Americans conducted last summer by Princeton Survey Research Association Associates International. It found that 55% of those using the internet are more concerned about online privacy now than they were 5 years ago. The most important reason that people surveyed gave was that they now know more about privacy issues than they did 5 years ago. Still, only 14% that say they often read privacy policies on websites. 36% said that they read the policies sometimes, while 50% read them rarely or not at all. The report does much to dispel suggestions that younger people don't care about privacy. The level of concern expressed was similar among age groups. However, the study notes that those in the 18 to 24-year-old group incorrectly believe that the law protects their privacy more than it does. This lack of knowledge is a tempting environment rather than the cavalier lack of concern regarding privacy may be an important reason large numbers of younger users engage with the digital world in a seemingly unconcerned manner, the report states. Among the findings, 88% refused to give information to a company or business because they thought it was too personal. 86% believed that anyone uploading a picture or video of them should first receive permission. 68% think that there should be a law that gives people the right to know everything that a website knows about them, and 92% feels that there should be a law requiring websites and advertising companies to delete all stored information on an individual. Now, I brought up this story because of the two Facebook privacy stories that I'm going to talk about next. A Facebook used to make partners delete your data after 24 hours, no more, sent in by Random Hero. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg announced this morning that the Facebook will toss a policy that made developers and partners with access to your data to delete it after 24 hours. Now they can just keep it. Turns out the privacy policies hindered growth. Zuckerberg told Inside Facebook, Zynga, makers of Mafia Wars and Farmville, has to download user information 100 million times per day because of our policy. Developers are having to architect entire systems just to do this. There aren't any other changes in the policy on how developers can use the data. Coming soon after their announcement that some pieces of your personal information will never be private, even if you set your profile to private, it's becoming clearer and clearer that Facebook won't let a little thing like respect for its users get in the way of a quest for total internet domination. And why should it? Most users don't hear about the changes or care. Which leads into the next story. This is from EFF.org. Facebook reduces your control, further reduces your control over personal information, sent in by DC. Once upon a time, Facebook could be used simply to share your interests and information with a small, select community of your own choosing. As Facebook's privacy policy once promised, no personal information that you submit to Facebook will be available to any user of the website who does not belong to at least one of the groups specified by you in your privacy settings. How times have changed. Today, Facebook removed its users' ability to control who can see their own interests and personal information. Certain parts of users' profile, including your current city, hometown, education, and work and likes and interests, will now be transformed into connections, meaning that they will be shared publicly. If you don't want these parts of your profile to be made public, your only option is to delete them. The example Facebook uses in its announcement is a page for cooking. Previously, you could list cooking as an activity you liked in your profile, but your name would not be added to any formal cooking page. Under the old system, you could become a fan of cooking if you wanted. But now, the new cooking page will publicly display all the millions of people who list cooking as an activity. Cooking is not a very controversial or privacy-sensitive, and thus makes for a good example from Facebook's perspective. Who would want to conceal their interest in cooking? Of course, the new program will also create public lists for controversial issues, such as interests in abortion rights, gay marriage, marijuana, tea parties, and so on. But even for an innocuous interest like cooking, it's not clear how this change is meant to benefit Facebook's users. An ordinary human is not going to look through the list of Facebook's millions of cooking fans. It's far too large. Only data miners and targeted advertisers have the time and inclination to delve that deeply. There is one loophole. Tell Facebook you're under 18. Under Facebook's policy for minors, your interests would only be visible for friends and family and verified networks. You would not be publicly listed on these new connection pages. However, this only works as you set up a new account. The new connections features benefit Facebook and its business partners with little benefit to you. Well, what are you going to do about it? Facebook has consistently ignored demands from its users to create an easy exit plan for migrating their personal data to another social networking website, even as it has continued one small privacy policy update after another to reduce its users' control over the information. The answer? Let Facebook hear your frustration. Last December, when Facebook announced this new round of privacy degradations, it provoked a potent combination of public outrage, legal threats, and government investigations. In response, Facebook listened to some criticism and walked back a few of its changes. Now it will allow the users to adjust the visibility of information in their profile, such as hiding your friends list from other friends. If you want Facebook to walk back these new changes, let them know how you feel. Update, a few people have contacted us by email through Facebook to ask for clarifications about this post. They're confused by the language in Facebook's announcement, which describes the new changes as opt-in. The issue with Facebook's latest changes is not that they force you to link your interest without permission, but rather they remove an option to express yourself in the profile without links. As we noted, Facebook's users now have to face a Hobson's choice between the new connections or no listed interests at all. As Facebook explains, if you didn't connect to any of the suggestions, the selections of your profile to which those suggestions correspond will now be empty. The transition tool also allows you to delay the choice by saying, ask me later. Previously, you could list interests in your profile without linking. After the transitions, you cannot. You do have the option to adjust visibility on the profile page, for which we commend Facebook. But nevertheless, this is not a true opt-out because of all the Facebook pages you connect to are public. Facebook users would be better off and better able to express themselves if they could choose whether or not to link their interests and activities to a community if they decide to list them. Also, EFF posted a video on YouTube today. I got it just before the show. I checked YouTube out. And they show how to avoid some of the privacy issues they're talking about in the article as well, with the sharing of your information with your friends and some of the other issues. So it's good to check out that. I'm going to link it in the Pirate Party Radio forums. So you can check out the video. There's no audio to it. So you just have to follow along where their mouse is going. It goes very slowly, and you can pause it and follow it to protect yourself a little bit more if you must use Facebook. Some people suggest just don't use Facebook at all, but in this day and age, a lot of people use Facebook. Hundreds of millions of people use Facebook. So that's not really a practical solution when people are definitely not going to stop using Facebook. So really, you should limit the amount of information that third parties can access, which is being more and more difficult being made by Facebook than ever before. Soon it's going to be reduced down to almost nothing that isn't going to be shared. DC also adds, this is why we need suicidemachine.org. So if you really want to completely wipe out your Facebook account as best as possible, because I've heard rumors that they actually don't delete your Facebook account, it's still kept there. But what suicidemachine.org does is that it reduces your Facebook account down to nothing first before deleting it. It's all automated by going through everything you've posted and deleting it one by one by clicking delete, 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 delete all your pictures, removes everything about you out of your interests, blanks everything out, and then finally changes your password and removes your account, so you can't even get back in if you wanted to. Copyright news from the U.S. New regulations on campus piracy don't mean new anti-piracy action sent in by Mind Inversion. Students are about to graduate often hand down the tricks of stealing music and movies to the next senior class in a digital rite of passage. At the College of New Jersey, this means surreptitiously finding a new home each year for a computer holding an enormous directory of illegal files on the campus. So says a senior at the college who is moving that computer to the dorm room of an underclassman who has agreed to maintain it next year. The machine runs software called Direct Connect, which lets people on a local network easily trade files among their hard drives in a way that is usually undetectable to anyone outside the network. The senior described the system only in the condition of anonymity. The senior estimates that about a third of the students on campus have used the service, grabbing movies, music, or episodes of TV shows. Regulations drafted by the U.S. Department of Education, which take effect early this summer, outline steps that colleges must take to prevent illegal swapping of copyrighted media. The rules were required by the Reauthorization Higher Education Act, but the College of New Jersey, like most others, has established no new policies or prevention methods as a result of the new laws, and no plans to do so. Those colleges following the letter of the law have strong strategic arguments for what they are not doing or not doing. Indeed, in the past, colleagues have gone well beyond legal requirements in their efforts to limit piracy. So some wonder if the law will have any practical impact, and if entertainment industry groups will ease up on campuses, which they have long made the target of their anti-piracy campaigns. At New Jersey, compliance with the new rules simply involved creating a web page listing of many things the institution was already doing. Running an educational campaign on the evils of illegal file trading, publishing a list of legal alternatives to piracy, and using a networking tool that limits the amount of large files that can be sent in and out of the campus network. None of these practices have eliminated underground pirate networks on many campuses. Nadine Stern, Vice President for Information Technology and Enrollment Services at the college, said that while it would be technically possible for her staff to detect large amounts of file trading on the campus, that is not something that they check for. We made the decision not to be the detectives and not to look for it, she said after I told her about the tradition of running the illegal trading hub there. We don't have the staff to do it, that or the inclination. It's not our philosophy. That may sound careless, but it's actually a strategic move and one that the college leaders believe that is best path to a long-term solution. The goal is to avoid a technological arms race that can drain college coffers to a minimal effect. Even if the colleges shut down the Direct Connect servers today, for example, something new and harder to police would very likely emerge in its place. At least that's the way Martin D. Ringel, Chief Technology Officer at Reed College, explained it to me, comparing illegal file trading to speeding on highways. People who say get out the technological sledgehammer are basically saying, let's put a cop behind every billboard on every highway across the US. How much would that cost and how oppressive would that be? The amount of speeding is not determined by the number of speed tracks set by enthusiastic cops, he said, but by the culture and value of the drivers. You try to get people to understand that it's their own safety that's the driving force. Now, this is very telling that they're understanding what the culture is nowadays. They can't stop it. They can try to win the war by influencing the hearts and minds of the students through campaigns, but they're basically being forced by the corporations to be the police of their own networks and hand down sentences to students who are going against the wishes of the corporations. Now, really, it's the corporation's business if they would like to take these students up on what they are doing or not doing on their own personal computers with, music or movies or things like that. But the college campuses are taking a stand saying, we are not going to do your dirty work for you. This is leading down the road to where we have to be compliant with everything you say. We're going to do the minimums as required by law, and that's all we're going to do. So applaud for those campuses. They're not following in the footsteps of many ISPs around the world by cracking down on their customers. Now, in other news, in another school, it's not going so well. Privacy news from the U.S. School IT allegedly took thousands of pictures in a webcam case. You may have already heard this story, but this is a follow-up to it, sent in by Fat Ninja. Remember the lawsuit filed by the family of 15-year-old Blake Robbins against the school district that spied on him via webcam at home? The latest news comes from a motion filed by the Robbins family claiming that the school took more than 400 photos of Blake in his room, some while sleeping, others while he was partially undressed. According to the motion filed Thursday, the Robbins family said that it was only aware of a handful of images being captured at the time that the lawsuit was filed back in February. Now, thanks to the court order asking the district to preserve evidence on all school-issued computers, the family has discovered more than 400 photos of Blake alone, not to mention the thousands more taken of other students in their home. In addition to these photos of students doing private things in their rooms, the school district also allegedly took screenshots of IM conversations they were having with friends. Even worse, the IT staff responsible for implementing and monitoring the students' laptops seemingly viewed the whole thing as entertainment. The motion cites emails sent between staffers. One said the pictures were like a little Lower Meridian School District soap opera. Carol Cafiero, one of the administrators responsible for the program, responded, "I know, I love it." Cafiero is one of the two staffers who have been placed on administration leave. The school district has always argued that it only turned on the webcams in the event that a laptop appeared lost or stolen. But the Robbins argued that there were numerous cases in which the school spied on students despite knowing exactly who had the laptops. Sometimes, students absentmindedly forgot to return their computers on time or failed to pay the $50 to $5 insurance fee in a timely manner. The latter was the case for Blake. The school said it initially spied on him because he failed to pay the fee. Though there appears to be no explanation at why the IT staff watched him for at least full 2 weeks before he ended up getting disciplined for improper behavior at home. They still haven't outlined what the improper behavior at home was. Understandably, the court has issued an order barring any of the 400 plus photographs or screenshots from being made available to anybody but the lawyers. Even if you think the school district was within its rights to install monitoring software on school laptops, the IT staff appear to have gotten the whole district into a hairy situation by turning laptop security into their own real-life high school soap opera. Well, this is particularly sickening abuse of power that the school has exerted over these students by providing these laptops. And this, I've read some other articles. This is the quite a well-to-do high school or school that they're able to provide thousands of laptops to their students at an expense of, I think, about $2.5 million. But this is the abuse that they've been able to inflict upon the students by spying on them at home and then laughing and trading the files with each other and commenting on them while the students are unaware that it's going on, but they know exactly what is going on and they're taking the pictures. This is something that people need to be aware of when you're dealing with technology that is not under your own control. So you need to know what is happening with the technology in your house and the capabilities of this technology. If it has a webcam, there is a possibility that this webcam can take photos by somebody that is in control of this computer. And even under the guise of a different like security that they've implemented this software under, they changed it into something that is grossly horrible in terms of privacy. So please know what the hardware in your house is doing. Investigate it, know what software is going on it, and check out what the software is capable of before letting it around your family or having cameras pointing in your rooms. Even from something as simple as a laptop, because there's been other reports, I haven't said them on the show, but another story is that this piece of hacked software, a virus that people have been installing, has been taking screenshots and blackmailing people, trying to get them to pay up. And this could be further exacerbated by turning on the webcam, which I don't think they have yet, but they have been able to take screenshots of what people are running, and they're trying to blackmail them. So it's very important that you know what is going on in your own hardware. Now, some copyright news from the UK. Down the EU piracy rabbit hole, sent by Mind Inversion. The article says, last week I wrote about a report from the U.S. Government Accountability Office that examined the reliability of recorded music industry research papers seeking to estimate the loss of piracy in the digital field, and found them all to be seriously wanting. As far as I know, no similar analysis has been carried out for European reports, so I thought it might be interesting to look at one particular European report on the subject, not least because I've heard its findings influence some of the MPs voting on the Digital Economy Act. The report is called Building a Digital Economy, and it comes from the International Chamber of Commerce. A new study entitled Building a Digital Economy, the Importance of Saving Jobs in the EU's Creative Industries, released today, predicts losses due to piracy to reach as much as 1.2 million jobs and £240 billion in retail revenue by 2015 in the creative industries most impacted, based on current trends and assuming no significant policy changes. The study shows this sector is already experiencing substantial losses. In 2008, the creative industries most impacted by piracy, film, TV series, recorded music, and software, experienced retail revenue losses of $10 billion and losses of more than 185,000 jobs due to piracy. These are big, frightening figures, and it's easy to understand why politicians might be impressed by them. But of course, anyone can bandy numbers around. The question is, do they have any basis in objective fact? At 68 pages, the report is quite long and very professionally produced. It is stuffed full of tables designed to bolster its case, and in calculating the claimed loss from piracy, a fairly simple approach is adopted. The number of copyright infringements are multiplied by the substitution rate, the percentage of people who would have bought stuff if they have not downloaded it for free, times the unit retail price. This is calculated for the top five economies in Europe, and scaled up proportionally to include all other EU economies. The claimed job losses that caused by revenue loss is obtained by dividing the latter by the average sales revenue per employee. I'm going to skip ahead a bit. where it goes down. The 7 million, they're talking about a figure that they came to. The 7 million figure had actually been rounded up from an actual figure of 6.7 million. The 6.7 million was gleaned from a 2008 survey of 1,176 net connected households, 11.6% of which admitting to having used file sharing software, in other words, only 136 people. It gets worse. That 11.6% of respondents who admitted to file sharing were adjusted upwards to 16.3% to reflect the assumption that fewer people admit to file sharing than actually do it. The report author told BBC that the adjustment wasn't just pulled out of thin air, but based on unspecified evidence. The 6.7 million then was calculated based on the estimated number of people with internet access in the UK. However, Jupiter Research was working on the assumption that there were 40 million people online in 2008, where the government's own official national statistics claimed there were only 33.9 million people during that year. And they go on to say that this was actually commissioned by the record companies and people with monetary interests in the amount of money lost or interest in the piracy that is happening. Now, when they forward that on to people who are unaware of who is sponsoring this, that will have a great influence on the outcome of votes and acts that are handed down, such as the Digital Economy Act that passed last week. So it is horribly skewed, and they're saying some outrageous amounts, $240 billion in retail revenue by 2015. Now, I ask again that I've asked before, where does this money come from? Does it come out of thin air? Do the people think that they'll stop buying some food so they can buy the music and movies that they have downloaded? I don't think that's going to be the case. People have a certain set budget, and they're going to allocate that budget as necessary. They're not going to be, all of a sudden, if nobody is able to download music or movies anymore, they're not going to be able to take resources from one thing that they had before, that they were using for something that's important, like feeding themselves, or clothing, or housing themselves, and all of a sudden magically be able to, give it over to the music industry or the movie industry. It doesn't work like that. If anything, they're going to spend money on used items. They're going to buy used DVDs and used music in the stores. And that does not put a red cent into the music industry or movie industry at all. So really, they're fighting the wrong fight. They're not going to be able to get any more money out of people because people are not going to spend it anyway. In privacy news from the U.S., Amazon fights demand for customer records sent in by D.C. Amazon.com filed a lawsuit on Monday to fend off a sweeping demand from North Carolina's tax collectors. Detailed records including names and addresses of customers and information about exactly what they purchased. The lawsuit says the demand violates privacy and First Amendment rights of Amazon's customers. North Carolina's Department of Revenue has ordered the online retailer to provide full details on nearly 50 million purchases made by state residents between 2003 and 2010. Amazon is asking a federal judge in Seattle to rule that the demand is illegal and left open the possibility of requesting a preliminary injunction against North Carolina's tax collectors. The best case scenario for customers would be where the North Carolina Department of Revenue withdraws their demand because they are recognized that it violates privacy rights of North Carolina residents, Amazon spokesperson Mary Osako told CNET. Because Amazon has no offices or warehouses in North Carolina, it's not required to collect the customary 5.75% sales tax on shipments. Although tax collectors have reminded residents that what's known as a used tax applies on anything purchased or received through the mail, the dispute arose out of what has otherwise been a routine sale and audit tax audit of Amazon by North Carolina's tax agency. A spokeswoman for the North Carolina Department of Revenue said that she would have to review the lawsuit before answering why the tax agency needed Amazon's customer information. Any commitment at this time would be premature, Beth Stevenson said in an email message. So they're wanting exactly what books you have published. This type of invasion of privacy, not even books, CDs, DVDs, anything that Amazon sells. Amazon sells just about everything in the U.S. and Canada. They really only sell the books and the DVDs, no computer parts or anything like that. But no level of invasion of privacy has ever come this high because in terms of getting information about what people are buying. Usually this is kept as a sacred thing between the customer and the person that they're purchasing from. And the person that's selling the item would have really retained not a lot of records they could pay in cash. Over the internet, you can't pay in cash. You have to pay through some traceable format. But right now, you could go into a store, buy a DVD, anything you want in a store, with cash. Nobody would know what your interests are, what kind of things that you're interested in, what kind of things you're researching through books or DVDs or CDs, and be able to take that purchase home. And now they're asking for a complete list of everything that you've bought for the last 7 years. And this is a huge invasion of privacy. Now, I'm sure nobody out there would want any kind of records, a list of records of things that people have purchased. And they rely upon the privacy expectations between themselves and Amazon.com as outlined in their privacy agreements. And Amazon is putting up a fight to try to defend what they have outlined in the privacy agreements. And they're going to go back on this. So something you bought in 2003, looking at the privacy, saying, knowing that nobody's going to know that you bought this book because you're embarrassed by it, or you're researching something, or you just don't. Why would anybody want anybody to know what they're looking at? It's not any of their business. It's your business. It's something that you want. You don't need this out in the public. And now the government is going to them and saying, give us all your information for the past 7 years. We want to know what people are buying. They have no need for the complete list of that. I can understand tax collection because they collect taxes in the stores, but they've asked for the list of the purchases. Very interesting. Copyright news from the U.S. EFF assails YouTube for removing Hitler Finds Out parodies, sent in by Mind Inversion. Now, everybody knows that there's been on YouTube, if you put up a video and it's something that's copyrighted, whether it's a music or a movie, it gets taken down, and they have a fingerprinting technology that is able to match up the audio and be able to identify copyright infringements by the audio fingerprint. And there's a great webpage on that, and somebody did a lot of experimentation on the audio fingerprinting matching technology. It's a little bit older. They might have improved it, but it really only went after the first 30 seconds of your clip. It ignores the rest of the movie. You can speed it up and slow it down, introduce noise, and at some certain point it breaks down. But anyway, this is talking about a clip from a movie. It's hard not to come across one of the many Hitler Finds Out internet memes. These viral videos parody Hitler's temper tantrum in the bunker scene from the 2004 independent movie Downfall. In reality, the bunker scene depicts Hitler reacting furiously to the news that the war is lost as Soviet troops close in on Berlin. The internet parody leaves the video and audio intact, but replaces the subtitles with Hitler reacting to ridiculous everyday events, like having his Xbox Live account canceled or finding out that Michael Jackson's died. The distributor of the film apparently doesn't have the sense of humor that the parodies invoke. According to the EFF, the film's distributor, Constantin Film, is using YouTube's automated content ID system to remove many of the parodies. This basically takes a Gatling gun to YouTube and fires blindly at anything resembling an unauthorized work, including parodies, which are protected by law in the U.S. From the EFF, in a depressing twist, these remixes are reportedly disappearing from YouTube thanks to Constant Film, the movie's producer and distributor, and YouTube's censorship-friendly automated filtering system, Content ID. Because Content ID filters permits a copyright owner to disable any video that contains its copyrighted content, whether or not that video contains other elements that make the non-infringing fair use. A content owner can take down a broad swath of fair uses with a flick of a switch, and it seems exactly what Constantin Film has chosen to do. This automated method indeed seems like the coward's way out, since if they file the DMCA complaint, there are legal consequences if it turns out the work in question wasn't copyrighted, such as parodies. Interestingly enough, EFF board member Brad Templeton's version, where Hitler is a movie producer ranting about sales declines, DMCA notices, and suing customers, is still available on YouTube. Global free speech and privacy news, Google reveals government data requests and censorship, sent in by Mind Inversion. For the first time, Google has released details about how often countries around the world ask it to hand over user data or to censor information. Brazil tops the list with 3,663 data requests, while the U.S. made 3,580 and the U.K. came a distant third with 1,166. Just last month, the internet giant pulled its search engine out of China over online censorship issues. Google said it cannot provide statistics on requests from China, which are regarded as state secrets. Brazil also made the highest number of requests of Google to remove content with 291 calls between July and December 2009. In second place was Germany with 188, India with 142, and the US with 123. The search giant has launched an online tool breaking down the figures, which is hoped to be just the first step towards increased transparency. The vast majority of these requests are valid, and the information needed is for legitimate criminal investigations or removal of child pornography, said David Drummond, Google's chief legal officer. We believe that the greater transparency will lead to less censorship. Unless companies, governments, and individuals do something, the internet we know is likely to become ever more restricted, taking choice and control away from users and putting more power in the hands of those who would limit access to information. Google has been at the center of a high-profile battle with China over the issue of censorship. It stopped censoring results earlier this year after the Gmail accounts of users associated with human rights groups were hacked. The company says the attacks had originated in China, while the Chinese authorities denied any involvement. Google's government request tool was unveiled on the same day that Canada's Privacy Commissioner sent an open letter to the company regarding privacy issues. Officials from 10 nations backed the complaints sent directly to Google bosses Eric Schmidt. The California-based firm said any suggestion that their release date was done to reflect the news was unrelated. Few companies publish any sort of data about such requests. We've been noticing a trend with these requests and working on this initiative for a long time, Scott Rubin, a senior spokesman with the company, told BBC News. This is really about our ongoing request to make information accessible, and we're hoping this inspire other companies to share data and become part of the conversation people are having about the scope of these kinds of requests. So that is great to see that they're opening up and showing what kind of requests are coming from what countries and which countries are the most concerned about data online from their citizens. In global copyright news, ACTA arrives. Still bad, but a tiny bit better. Sent in by Mind Inversion. Yes, the ACTA has been released in full. We've been covering the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement for 2 years now. This is from Ars Technica. And in that entire 24-month, no official text of the agreement has been released. Remarkably, really, given the intense scrutiny. But there you have it. Today, that all changed as the countries behind ACTA finally released a consolidated draft text of the agreement. Though billed as a trade agreement about counterfeiting, ACTA is much more than that. It's intellectual property treaty in disguise. New to this draft is an option, clearly targeting European law, that it would explicitly allow internet disconnections. Tucked inside the draft are provisions that will prevent people from bypassing digital locks on the items they buy, that will force ISPs to shoulder more of the burden on the fight against online piracy, and that will bring US-style notice and takedown rules to the world. Well, not the world exactly. ACTA is more like a select club of countries. Australia, Canada, European Union countries, Japan, Korea, Mexico, Morocco, New Zealand, Singapore, Switzerland, and the United States of America. But the treaty it develops is really the next rung on the ladder, stretching back to 1886, and will clearly be wielded like a weapon on the rest of the world in the future. The text is not final. That is due to happen later this year. So if you want to see changes made, time to act is now. After a year of partial leaks and finally complete leaks, ACTA's basic outlines are familiar. Now I'm going to skip down to what they are talking about that is outlined here. Anti-circumvention DRM. Well, ACTA draft adopts the best part of DMCA, copyright safe harbors, it also adopts the worst, making it illegal to bypass DRM locks. So if you put something on your piece of hardware, like even the simplest of encryptions, nobody is allowed to manipulate that piece of hardware at all, such as DVD players that were put in with the DCSS code so that people couldn't copy their DVDs. If anybody even decrypted the DVDs at all, that would be an illegal thing to do. ACTA would ban the unauthorized circumvention of effective technological measures. It also bans circumvention devices, even those with limited commercial significant purpose. So even if it has some purpose at all, other than to do to circumvent the DRM, it's still banned. It doesn't matter if it's good, bad, otherwise, if it breaks the DRM, it's out of there. iPod scanning border guards. Early ACTA commentators have often complained that the agreement might give customs officials the right to rifle through your bags and search your iPods, confiscating if they determined that it contained any infringing songs. Border guards might become copyright cops, turning out the bags of anyone who's visited China, say, to see if they might bring you some homesome illegal copies of movies or software. This was always a strange idea. ACTA's backers are hunting bigger game than iPods. The draft text contains a de minimis provision that allowed countries to exclude from ACTA enforcement small quantities of goods of a non-commercial nature contained in a traveler's personal luggage. Well, thank you for throwing a bone on that one, so our personal items won't be confiscated at the border if they hear even a snippet of a song. The real copyright cops. ACTA contains ex officio, a language that allows customs officials and border guard agents to hold infringement shipments of goods without needing a rights holder to complain first. Several opinions are being considered in the draft, but all give the authorities the right to act upon their own initiative in releasing suspected goods at customs checkpoints. So all they have to do is say that it is a suspected goods for making money rather than personal use, so they could say, well, you're bringing it over to sell, and then they can keep all your stuff. Imminent infringement. Several sections of the ACTA draft show that the right holders can obtain an injunction just by showing that infringement is imminent, even if it hasn't happened yet. Now, that one's scary. This is like pre-crime talking about, we think you're going to infringe on something. We think you're going to put this on the internet. We think you're going to record or make a remix of this song. So we're going to shut down your internet. P2P without financial gain. ACTA requires criminal penalties against willful copyright infringement when done on a commercial scale. Early drafts explicitly mention online piracy, and that seems to be in the view. Though this section remains under negotiation, the draft shows that this may apply to infringements that have no direct or indirect motivation of financial gain. In other words, P2P distribution, where this exact issue of financial gain has come up in numerous court cases. So they don't care if you're making money on it or not making money on it. If you're distributing to one person or many, it's going down. Proportional penalties. At least one enterprising ACTA country has managed to insert this interesting line into the section of enforcement procedures in the digital environment. Those measures, procedures, and remedies shall also be fair and proportionate. A dig at internet disconnections and three strikes remedies, which are often criticized on these grounds. Whose knows? And it's under debate. So, some very interesting portions of the ACTA being picked out by Ars Technica, and I'm sure we're going to see in the coming weeks people dissecting the ACTA agreement and being able to apply it to real world situations and how this is going to be enforced. So I'm looking forward to people dissecting this act. In copyright news from Australia, AFACT wants Aussie government to force ISPs to fight peer-to-peer, sent in by DC. Not a big surprise there. Australian Federation Against Copyright Theft Executive Director Adrian Pikotic said that ISPs refuse to create a voluntary code to deal with copyright infringement on their networks, and that unless the government follows the lead of countries like the UK and France, where the government forced one upon them, the country's digital economy is at risk. Adrian Pikotic, the Executive Director of the Australian Federation Against Copyright Theft, is asking the Australian government to force ISPs to deal with the copyright infringement on their network, especially in light of its court loss to iiNet, where a judge ruled the ISP was not liable for customers using BitTorrent to illegally share their copyrighted material on its network. I find the mere provision of access to the internet is not the means of infringement, said the judge in his ruling. INET has no control over the BitTorrent system and is not responsible for the operation of the BitTorrent system. He added, the government urged AFACT and the ISPs to voluntarily devise a code of conduct for dealing with copyright infringement. But according to Australian IT, AFACT complains that ISPs are refusing to negotiate, a charge which INET strongly denies. The internet industry and copyright holders have been in detailed discussions for a number of years before AFACT and its executive director, Ms. Pikotic, called off negotiations in August 2007 to commence their unsuccessful legal proceedings against INET in the federal court. It says in a statement, clearly AFACT are not part of the solution, instead appear only to hinder the process of developing mutual beneficial business relationships. Prior to the federal court hearing, INET again sought to negotiate with AFACT on these matters, but they refused. So what they're going to do is use the model that they've used in France and the UK now to implement the same thing in Australia to make the ISPs liable and the enforcement for the copyright infringements of their users, so that so it's almost an automated process where any infringers get kicked off the internet. It's basically a scare tactic, because they really don't want these people necessarily off the internet. What they want to do is put the scare into the public so that people stop downloading music and movies off of the internet to use for non-commercial uses. And whether or not they think that's going to be successful, I don't think it's going to be successful. Even if they do get people to stop downloading off the internet, they're just going to find it a different way, either through sneaker nets, or they're just not going to consume it anymore, and they're going to go for other alternatives, such as places that don't care, and musicians and movie studios that don't care about people downloading it off the internet, and can see that they are promotional tools to sell the real product now, which is the experience that they have to sell now with, like, movies and music. For movies, it's in the theater, it's the great sound system, it's the cutting-edge video that they're showing on the screen, such as Avatar, made almost $3 billion. And with music, it's going to the live show, getting a t-shirt, experiencing the same thing. Maybe the movie stars can come and show their premieres around the world innovate in these entertainment industries rather than go after your customers, which is not going to create a very nice environment. Very hostile environment when you're suing your customers. Copyright news from Italy. We'll stomp out a good note here. Italian ISPs ruled not responsible for file sharing customers, sent in by DC. The far-reaching demands of the anti-piracy group working on behalf of the movie industry have been rejected by a judge. Federazione Antipiratera Audiovisiva wanted ISP Telecom Italia to take unprecedented action against file-sharing subscribers, but the court decided the ISP couldn't be held responsible for the action of its customers. Applaud, applaud. Much like every other industry, after failing to bring online piracy under control by other methods, the music and movie industries have been increasingly turning to the courts to force ISPs into action against their own customers. In Italy, movie anti-piracy group FAPAV went to the court in an attempt to compel Italy's largest ISP, Telecom Italia, to take unprecedented action against subscribers. FAPAV said they are infringing their members' copyrights. In the April 15th ruling that had become public, Judge Antaniello Izzo largely rejected FAPAV's demands. FAPAV wanted the court to force Telecom Italia to monitor its users, report those who file share to the authorities, and block them along with a range of web locations, including BitTorrent sites, the Pirate Bay, LeetX, and ISOHunt. FAPAV also called for fines of 10,000 euros per day if Telecom Italia refused to comply. So they really went for it. They wanted everything. Wow. But in a big blow for PAFAV, Judge Izzo ruled that the internet service providers cannot be held responsible for the material carried over their networks and rejected calls for user and site blocking. The demand that huge fines should be imposed on Telecom Italia for non-compliance was also rejected. So somebody with some common sense, knowing that the ISPs are really a common carrier and don't have the resources to be the jackboots for the corporation. So applaud to Italy. In Pirate Party news and events, Swedish Pirate Party demonstration against ACTA on April 24th. So if you're in Sweden, you can show up for this. On Saturday, the Pirate Party in Stockholm organized a demonstration against the consolidation now released, the Draft Trade ACTA. Sorry, this is translated. Location is the Civic Square at the entrance to Civic Hall. Time is 1500 hours, 3 p.m., and lasts until 1730, 5:30 p.m. Show up, and you can also tell from the ACTA agreement. All are, of course, are welcome regardless of party sympathies. The list of speakers is not yet finished, but some expected speakers are Rick Falkvinge, party leader, Pirate Party, Robert Nyberg, board member of the Young Pirates Stockholm, Anna Troberg, author and deputy leader of Pirate Party, Carl Johan Rickbinder, parliamentary candidate for Pirate Party, and these are all Pirate Party of Sweden, of course. And next, this information from Pirate Party International. 22 pirate parties from all over the world officially founded the Pirate Parties International. This weekend, from April 16th to 18th, delegates from pirate parties from 22 countries created the Pirate Parties International. The aim of this international organization of pirate parties is to help establish, to support and promote, and to maintain communication and cooperation between pirate parties around the world. Even though nature was sending rough waters by means of volcanic ashes, closed airspace, and the train strike in France, it wasn't an obstacle for pirates from 18 countries to find a safe harbor in Brussels. The pirate movement is growing and gaining momentum. It was the next logical step to found an international organization to coordinate the efforts of the pirate parties to cooperate on an international level, said PPI co-chairman Gregory Ingels. After a tour of the European Parliament and a speech of Swedish pirate MEP Christian Engström on Friday, April 16th, 32 delegates from 18 countries gathered in Brussels to discuss the statutes of PPI. An easy way to follow the conference has been arranged for those who were cut out of Brussels completely, as all pirates worldwide could follow the sessions over a video stream and take part in the group discussions over chat. Shortly after 2200 hours, on Saturday, April 17th, the delegates and remote participants accepted the statutes of the Pirate Party International. On Sunday, April 18th, the conference closed with the elections of the new board. The very first objective to improve the international communications of the PPI, said co-chairman Jerry Weyer. We also continue to establish task forces for current common topics of the pirate parties like ACTA or INDECT. And of course, we will improve the structure of PPI, for example, by creating the headquarters that will serve as administrative entity or by inviting everyone to propose amendments to the statute. So congratulations to Pirate Party International for coming together and being able to form a cohesive informational node to be able to disseminate information out to everybody that needs it. And I've posted a link to an interesting 15-minute documentary about copyright called When Copyright Goes Bad. It was sent in by Mobile Diesel, so a quick little view there, interesting little piece of film with some people that have interest in copyright. And for my closing words, this is a great clip talking about the freedom of information that was sent in by LaTrans. It's from the video game Alpha Centauri, made in 1999. LaTrans comments on an ironically humorous note, "This video is unavailable to me unless I use a proxy. I'll have to yell at my ISP again about this. It's not the first time I've caught them filtering my content." So remember, if any of these stories have interested you, please check out your local pirate party to find out more about what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. If you have any news stories you'd like to hear on the show, questions or comments, just head over to thepiratepartyradio.com, submit them or through the form on the website. So thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.
As the Americans learned so painfully in Earth's final century, free flow of information is the only safeguard against tyranny. The once chained people whose leaders at last lose their grip on information flow will soon burst with freedom and vitality. But the free nation, gradually constricting its grip on public discourse, has begun its rapid slide into despotism. Beware of he who would deny you access to information, or in his heart he dreams himself your master.